So you can see what Rush meant when he said, "It was despicable." And you can see what Jeff Greenfield meant when he said the event backfired for the Democrats. And you can see what Chris Caldwell meant when he said the Democrats were dancing a jig on the grave of a particularly beloved fallen comrade. You can see what Peggy Noonan meant when she wrote, "That memorial was a triumph of politics at the expense of the personal, at the expense of what makes you human." And you can see that the media has a liberal bias. Yes, there's a difference between the left and the right. There's a difference between Democrats and Republicans. The day after the memorial, Rush Limbaugh told us his theory of what it is.
"The point," he said, "is that these people are committed to mind control, and we are committed to freedom. That's the difference."
Tucker Carlson had a different theory. "You guys really believe," he told me, "that politics can change people's lives." Well, I do believe that. Here's a real story about how politics changed a life. When my wife Franny was 18 months old, her father, a World War II vet who fought in the Battle of the Bulge, died in a car accident. Her mother, at age 29, was a widow with no college education and five children. They lived in a house in Maine that they bought through a GI loan. Franny's mom worked in the produce department at a grocery store, which added just enough to her Social Security income to allow them to almost scrape by. Sometimes the heat was turned off or the phone was turned off. Franny's brother went into the Coast Guard, and the four girls all got college educations, thanks in part to Pell Grants and Department of Defense student loans. There are millions of stories like this. Almost every American family has a story like this. What the hell was Tucker talking about? I'm not saying that everything government does is good or bad. It's just that it's not a game. Politics can be vicious and dirty and cruel, or, for people like Paul Wellstone and those that loved him, it can be a part of what makes us human. At the memorial, they showed a short film about Paul's life that captured who he was and what he believed. It had a clip from a speech. In that passionate, exuberant cadence that everyone in the arena remembered from every time they had heard him speak, Paul said,
"Politics is not about power. Politics is not about money. Politics is not about winning for the sake of winning. Politics is about the improvement of people's lives. It's about advancing the cause of peace and justice in our country and in our world. Politics is about doing well for people."
Chapter 26. I attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner and annoy Karl Rove, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, and the entire Fox News team. I love the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I've performed there twice. In 1994, it was the scene of my greatest triumph, by Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot for details. In 1996, Newt Gingrich almost slugged me, by the paperback edition of Rush. This year, we were at war, so instead of the usual comedian, the entertainment was Ray Charles. Judging from this year and from 1999, when Aretha Franklin sang, the Correspondents Association have decided that it's bad form to have a comedian during a war or an impeachment. I came as a guest of U.S. News and World Report, and I was very excited. 3,000 people in tuxes and gowns, except the generals and admirals who were in dress uniform, were gathered in the Washington Hilton Ballroom. I thought of renting a 4-star general uniform from a costume house in New York and wearing that, but, you know, again, we were at war. So there were all these senators and cabinet officers and White House officials and Fox News people. Frankly, I was salivating. The night before, I had done one of my wildly successful corporate gigs in Reno, Nevada, and I arrived at the Hilton just a half an hour before dinner. After showering quickly, I nicked my chin shaving, then put some toilet paper on the cut so it wouldn't bleed on my tux shirt as I fiddled with the studs and cufflinks. I headed downstairs to make an appearance at the U.S. News and World Report cocktail party, holding a handkerchief to my chin to make sure I was sufficiently coagulated for the evening. On the way there, Matt Drudge said hi to me, and I said hi back. I bring this up not because I think you'll be impressed if I drop his name, but for a reason you'll hear in a bit. By the time I got to dinner, my platelets had done their job, and I was looking quite dapper. I sat between the Irish ambassador, who had a delightful Irish brogue, and Jody Allen, a managing editor of U.S. News and World Report, who's brilliant and charming and really beautiful. But as happy as I was between Jody and Pat, Mike, whatever, I was taking a good look around. At the table in front of us was Commerce Secretary Don Evans, one of the president's closest friends. At the table to our right was Richard Perle, the neocon war profiteer, who had recently resigned as chairman of the Defense Policy Board because of a financial conflict of interest, but had remained on the board itself for reasons that will puzzle ethicists for centuries. At a table to our left, the jackpot, Karl Rove. Karl Rove! And as the Marine band played Hail to the Chief, we both stood, not 2 feet apart, both applauding the president as he entered the room and took his place on the dais. Rove took note and called out to a White House pal, grinning, "Hey, look, Franken's applauding the president." "Of course I am," I said, as I continued applauding heartily. "He's the president of the United States. He's my president. He's your president. He's the president elected fair and square." "Well, he's the president." "He was elected fair and square," Rove said, as we both kept applauding. "I don't think so." "Do you believe in the Constitution?" Rove asked me. "Yes, I believe in the Constitution," I said with a firm nod. "Then he was elected fair and square," he said. "That doesn't necessarily follow," I answered. "I believe in the Constitution, but he wasn't elected fair and square." That was fun. Then 3,000 people, including me, drank a toast to the president and sat down, and I learned a little about Ireland from Liam, Seamus, whatever. Nothing interesting enough to tell you. I peeked at the program, which had a seating chart, and found Alan Combs' table among all the Fox people. I'd been watching a lot of Hannity and Combs during the war in Iraq and had something I thought Alan could use against Hannity. So, after my salad, I moseyed over to table 251. As you can imagine, Don Evans, Richard Perle, and Karl Rove were at very nice tables dead center in front of the stage, which meant I was sitting pretty, too. For some reason, Fox had lousy seats, as far to one side of the ballroom as possible. And when I reached the Fox tables, I saw that Alan was sitting directly behind a pillar. He had an obstructed view. I looked around the ballroom and saw that in the entire place, there were 4 obstructed views. Alan Combs had one of them. Seated next to Alan was his fiancée, who is absolutely lovely. Alan introduced us, and I told him he's a very lucky man. Then I said, "Alan, I've been watching your show a lot during this war, and I think I have something that might help you." "Oh, really? What?" "Well, every day, Hannity goes after Democrats if they make even the mildest criticism of Bush. He says they're undermining the commander-in-chief while our men and women are in harm's way." "Yeah," Alan nodded. "Well, I did a nexus on your show during Kosovo, and every day during Kosovo, Hannity was saying things 100 times worse about Clinton than any Democrat has said about Bush. He said Clinton can't be trusted, he's not following his advisors, he's doing a terrible job. At one point, he even said, we're running out of ammunition." "That's interesting," Alan nodded. "Interesting. Yeah, I'll look it up." "Look it up? You're going to use it, right?" "Well, that's not the format of our show." "Not the format of your show. We don't go after each other. We go after the guests." "But if he keeps repeating something so blatantly hypocritical, why can't you?" "That's not the format of our show. Look, I watch your show. Over and over, Hannity keeps saying that 90 million Americans are going to get a $1,000 tax cut. And I've corrected him on that," Alan said. "Yeah, once in a while, 5 minutes after he lies, you say something about how that's an average, not a typical family. But the next day he says it again. Can you at least talk to him after the show and tell him to stop?" "Well, we really don't. That's not the format of their relationship." I understood for the first time the genius of their format. Hannity, a right-wing propagandist, gets to lie and distort show after show, and Combs, a moderate milquetoast who doesn't lie and distort, is not allowed to call him on it. Perfect. "So basically, you're lying down," I said. "No, I'm not lying down." "Yes, you are. You're lying down." At that moment, a handsome young man who looked like a morning sports anchor came charging at me and got in my face. "Why are you bothering Alan?" he said menacingly. "What are you doing here?" There was only one thing to do. I moved in an inch from his face. Narrowing my eyes, I asked, "Who are you?" He told me he was Brian Kilmeade, the sports anchor on the FNC morning show Fox and Friends. There we were, face to face. two fierce men. One about 30 and in very good shape. The other 51 with chronic back pain. A classic standoff. Time seemed to stand still. Then some drunk from one of the Fox tables asked if he could get a picture. I said, sure. Spun Brian around and put my arm around his shoulders. Smile, I told Brian, who seemed confused. Whoever has that picture, can I get it for the paperback? I spent a few more minutes in the midst of the Fox people. Not arguing, really. It was more in the way of slightly hostile banter. Fun. Back to my table, I sidled over to Rove. I got a great idea for you, I said. It'll really help the president. When they announce Ray Charles, have the president lead him out and play a trick on him. The president tells Ray he's leading him to his piano, but he takes him to the podium. Everyone will love it. No, Rove said curtly. Hey, this is one you might want to give a couple minutes thought. No. Back to my assigned seat for the entree, of which I have no memory. The Irish ambassador, Owen, told me something about something. After dinner, the president spoke. As you know, I don't like the man, but his remarks about the courage of journalists in Iraq and specifically about the deaths of Michael Kelly and David Blum struck just the right note. No jokes, good call. The president didn't play a trick on Ray Charles. Unfortunately, the crowd did. The man may be a national treasure, but 3,000 Beltway biggies were not very interested in listening to him sing. About 5 minutes into his set, folks were walking around, schmoozing, speaking loudly in order to be heard over the din. It must have been like playing the lounge at a Holiday Inn in Phoenix, but worse. As a comedian, I make a point of being polite to other performers, and so I listened to and applauded each song as people crisscrossed in front of me. During the fourth or fifth number, I noticed Richard Perle, the former chair of the Defense Policy Board, talking to my friend Jonathan Alter of Newsweek at the next table. The New York Times had recently disclosed that Perle had been hired by Global Crossing to lobby the Pentagon, which the Defense Policy Board advises. Global Crossing wanted the Pentagon to allow a Hong Kong enterprise with close ties to the Chinese government to acquire the bankrupt telecom company. Perle's fee? $125,000, plus a $600,000 bonus if the deal went through. Conflict of interest? Yeah, kinda. The LA Times found another icky one. As chair of the Defense Policy Board, Perle had received a classified briefing on Iraq and North Korea. A few days later, Goldman Sachs paid Perle to join a conference call with a select group of investors to tell them how to take advantage of this information. Oddly enough, I knew about this sleazy little arrangement before the Times broke it. A 20-year-old Team Franken member, who happens to be the scion of a ridiculously wealthy family, had been invited to be on the call. My Team Franken member, let's call him Horace Rockefeller, was sworn to secrecy, so I can't tell you what Perle said. But let's put it this way. I wouldn't invest in any real estate investment trusts with property along the Seoul subway line. So screw Ray Charles. This was my chance to bother Richard Perle. I waited for a lull in the conversation and jumped in. Mr. Perle, Al Franken, he nodded. Say, how do I get in on this gravy train, I asked. I feel like I've missed the boat on this whole war. Invest in my fund, he said. I wasn't sure if he was serious. I'll send you a portfolio. Like an idiot, I didn't take him up on it. That would have been juicy reading. Instead, I asked him about his threat to sue journalist Seymour Hersh, who had just exposed one of his shady deals in The New Yorker, for libel. Perle had called Hersh, quote, the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist, and then threatened to sue him in Great Britain, where journalists aren't protected by our silly First Amendment. Weeks had passed without Perle suing, and it has become increasingly obvious that Perle had been bluffing just to save face while the story was big. Why don't you sue him here, I suggested snarkily. That'd really show everyone how strong your case is and how reckless Hersh had been. See, this is why I wouldn't make a good journalist. Here I could have gotten the portfolio for Perle's fund, and instead I had to go one step too far and piss the guy off. Speaking of pissing off a neocon, later at the after party given by Bloomberg News, I went up to Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the architect of the Bush preemption doctrine. Hi, Dr. Wolfowitz. Hey, the Clinton military did a great job in Iraq, didn't it? He looked at me for a couple seconds, then said, "Fuck you," which I thought was funny. I think he was kidding on the square, a phrase I hope will catch on. It means kidding, but also really meaning it. People do it all the time, kidding on the square. If this book does two things, I want it to get kidding on the square into the lexicon, and I want it to get Bush out of the White House. Then Wolfowitz and I had a short argument. "The Clinton military never would have done this war," he said. "Well, maybe they wouldn't have done it, but they could have." "This is a completely different military," he said. Then he talked about the influx of money since Bush's defense budget kicked in. By the way, it kicked in during October 2002. I said, "Let me ask you, did you guys actually make any of the machines that have been used in Iraq?" That got him all pissed off again. So he got into how they've reorganized the military and technical arguments on how they've changed the command structure. I mean, he is Deputy Secretary of Defense, and I have to admit he lost me. But of course, he was wrong, I was right, but I'll get into all of this in a later chapter. Yeah, well, fuck you. Actually, it's called Bush Can't Lose with Clinton's Military, and after you hear it, I think you'll agree that Bill Clinton remains the greatest president of the 21st century. As exciting as my little Noel Coward tete-a-tete was with Wolfowitz, I had my most interesting and perhaps most significant conversation that night with Commerce Secretary Don Evans. Evans is among Bush's closest friends and was featured heavily in Howard Fineman's Newsweek cover story, Bush and God. That was the top-selling Newsweek since 9/11. As you probably know, until his 40th birthday, Bush was a heavy drinker, or as we call them at Harvard, a drunk. According to many accounts, Bush was also an obnoxious drunk. Finally, Laura Bush laid down the law. Threatened with losing sex from his wife, Bush decided to quit drinking and turn to Christ. That part about sex is not in the Newsweek article. It was Evans, a fellow oilman, who coaxed his old friend George into joining a Bible study group in Midland. According to Newsweek, it was a spiritual boot camp, an intensive year-long study of a single book of the New Testament, each week a new chapter, with detailed reading and discussion in a group of 10 men. For 2 years, Bush and Evans and their partners read the clear writings of the Gentile physician Luke, Acts, and then his gospel. Now, I'm a Jew, and I grew up knowing zip about the New Testament and still know next to zip. But as it so happened, a few days before the correspondence dinner, I ran into economist Paul Solomon at the Harvard gym. Paul, who teaches a course in business ethics, is also a Jew, but an educated one, so he knows the Bible, and he, too, had read Fineman's cover story. He told me he found it ironic that Acts was one of the two books Bush and Evans had studied. Acts, Paul told me, is Luke's account of the formation of the church after Christ's death. The book is almost a socialist tract, full of admonishments to the rich to share their wealth with the poor. The communist motto, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need," is derived from Acts 4:32 through 35. Here's the whole passage. "And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them, and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need." In the Hilton Ballroom, after Ray Charles had finished and received a perfunctory ovation, I saw Evans sitting alone at his table. I sidled into the seat next to him. "Mr. Secretary, do you mind if I speak with you?" "Not at all, Al." I liked him immediately. After some niceties, I steered the conversation toward Acts and how its message seemed at odds with the shape of the Bush tax cut. I led into it with, "Did you read Howard Fineman's cover story in Newsweek on Bush and God?" "Yes," Evans said. "Did you like it?" "Yes, so did I said. "So you know what Acts is about." Evans looked a little uncomfortable. Long pause, then, "No. It was a scriptural boot camp, an intensive year-long study of a single book of the New Testament, Each week, a new chapter with detailed reading and discussion in a group of 10 men. For 2 years, Bush and Evans and their partners read the clear writings of the Gentile physician Luke, Acts, and then his gospel. No? No. Based on what Paul Solomon had told me, and a subsequent glance at the Complete Idiot's Guide to the Life of Christ, I explained to the scriptural boot camp survivor what I understood Acts to be about. Then I went into my spiel about the unfairness of the tax cut. Ah, Evan smiled. But Acts also has Jesus' parable of the talents. No, I said, that's in Matthew. The parable of the talents is a story Jesus told about a master giving 3 servants each a sum of money. When the master returns, 2 of the men have used the money to make more money. The other man buried the money in the ground. The master rewards the men who made money from the money and punishes the schmuck who didn't. Moral, God wants you to use your gifts. Conservatives tend to interpret the parable literally as an exhortation to get rich. Now, it was a complete fluke that I had any clue at all about talents. Last year, my son Joe had been assigned some New Testament readings in his mostly Jewish private high school and had to write a short paper on, yep, talents. He couldn't understand it and came to me. I couldn't make any sense of it either, so I called Gary Bauer. That's right, Gary Bauer, Goldberg's little nut from the Christian group. As I said, Gary and I are friends. Honestly, it's a long story, but we like each other. And what better guy to explain a parable in Matthew, not Acts? Gary wasn't home, so his wife Carol, who's also a friend, though I think she has grave doubts about me, explained talents. Since then, I've noticed that the only biblical parable supply-siders ever mention is talents. And for all I can tell, it might be the only one Evans knows, but even I was surprised Evans didn't know what book it was from. What do you suppose those guys were really doing during their scriptural boot camp? Watching football? Eating pretzels? Plotting with Karl Rove how to use religious rhetoric to reassure the Christian right base that George W. was one of them? Epilogue. 2 days later, the right-wing website Newsmax.com ran a piece on me. Al Franken goes fox hunting at correspondents' dinner, saying that I had, quote, accosted a table full of Fox News Channel personalities, causing a scene that threatened to erupt into physical violence. Kilmeade said Franken's behavior was so deranged that some thought he was drunk, but that wasn't the case. I personally thought we'd end up coming to blows. According to internet scribe Matt Drudge, when witnesses spotted the liberal ranter later, he was bleeding from the chin. But Kilmeade said the alteration stopped short of throwing punches. Drudge, remember, had seen me holding my handkerchief to my chin before the dinner. But these guys love to lie, like Bill Bennett loves to gamble and Newt Gingrich loves to have mistresses. I'm sorry, I don't know if Newt is really cheating on this new wife of his. I hope they're doing well. It's just a running joke I'm using. I think that the personal lives of public officials should stay out of the domain of our national discourse unless it affects their job performance or reveals a particularly craven level of hypocrisy. And on the latter point, I think Newt qualifies, hence the running joke. I'm kidding about Newt's infidelities, but remember, I'm kidding on the square. Chapter 27, The Lying Years. I've known since the 2000 Republican National Convention in Philadelphia that if Bush and Cheney were elected, their time in office would be remembered by history as the lying years. That's because for the first time since the Free Soil Convention of 1852, both the presidential and vice presidential candidates of a major political party lied in their acceptance speeches. In his acceptance speech at the 1852 Free Soil Convention in Pittsburgh, presidential candidate John P. Hale grossly overstated the incidence of flogging in the United States Navy. His running mate, George W. Julian, falsely charged that Whig standard-bearer Winfield Old Fuss and Feathers Scott had personally flogged dozens of soldiers under his command during the Mexican War. This was particularly insidious given Scott's commitment to professionalizing the military. Bush lied while claiming that Clinton had undermined the readiness of the military. He said, "If called on by the commander-in-chief today, two entire divisions of the Army would have to report, 'Not ready for duty, sir.'" That was contradicted by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, by Defense Secretary William Cohn, and by Bush's own foreign policy advisor at the time, Richard Armitage, who is now Deputy Secretary of State. The following is an excerpt from a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee held a few days later. Carl Levin was the committee's ranking member. Levin: "But I want to get back to the two divisions not being ready for duty, because Mr. Armitage has not answered that. Are those two divisions ready for duty or aren't they?" Richard Armitage: "I believe those two divisions, Senator, are ready for duty." "That's not what Governor Bush said the other night, and that's why I think an apology is appropriate." But instead of apologizing, Armitage bolted from the hearing room, knocking over veteran reporter Helen Thomas, breaking her hip and jaw. Cheney's lie was more subtle, but I think more telling. After a speech bitterly denouncing the Clinton-Gore legacy of peace and prosperity, he switched to a more reflective tone and told a personal story, describing the helicopter ride from Andrews Air Force Base to the Pentagon, a trip he had taken so often as Secretary of Defense. Cheney invoked the great leaders and terrible sacrifices that forged this nation. "You fly down along the Mall and see the monument to George Washington, a structure as grand as the man himself. To the north is the White House, where John Adams once prayed that none but honest and wise men may ever rule under this roof. Next, you see the memorial to Thomas Jefferson, the third president who blah, 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 blah. Then you cross the Potomac on approach to the Pentagon. But just before you settle down on the landing pad, you look upon Arlington National Cemetery, its gentle slopes and crosses row on row. I never once made that trip without being reminded how enormously fortunate we all are to be Americans, and what a terrible price thousands have paid so that all of us, and millions more around the world, might live in freedom." I was starting to tear up by the time Cheney got to Arlington Cemetery. I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. But when he said, "crosses row on row," I flinched. The gravestones in Arlington National Cemetery are not crosses. Had he really said that? Cheney was lying. The graves in Arlington are marked with white rectangular headstones rounded at the top. There are no crosses row on row that Cheney could have seen from his helicopter. The phrase, "crosses row on row," comes from a poem, Flanders Field, about a World War I cemetery in Belgium. It seems bizarre that a guy who made that helicopter trip so many times, particularly the Secretary of Defense, would not remember the unforgettable sight of Arlington's vast gardens of stone. The most generous explanation I can think of is that Cheney had been watching Saving Private Ryan the night before he accepted the nomination and had the cemetery from the last scene stuck in his head. But can you imagine if Al Gore had said this? The media's reaction would have dominated the campaign for the next month. "He is desecrating our war dead. He says, 'I never once made that trip without looking down at those graves.' Did he ever really look even once? Did he ever visit the graves of America's heroes? Has there ever been a more shameless attempt to wrap yourself in both God and country? My Jewish father died defending Al Gore's religious freedom, and he is not buried under a cross. How dare he? How dare he?" But it wasn't Gore who said it. It was Cheney. And from the liberal media? Silence. Chapter 28. Bush Can't Lose with Clinton's Military. Did Clinton gut the military because there was no evidence that countries like Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and an increasingly aggressive communist China would represent serious future threats to America and our friends and allies? No. Rather, it was because he loathed the military. Sean Hannity, Let Freedom Ring, page 76. Do I continue to quote Let Freedom Ring because there is no evidence to support his claims? Partly, but mostly it's because I loathe Sean Hannity, and because I think he represents a serious threat to America and our friends and allies. On page 82 of Hannity's ringing denunciation of the left, he produces what is quite simply the greatest table I've ever seen. I'll read it for you. Comparison of defense budgets. Reagan-Bush, 1986, versus Clinton-Gore, 1996. First item, new tanks requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 1986, 840. Clinton-Gore, 1996, zero. New tactical aircraft requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 399. Clinton-Gore, 34. New naval ships requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 40. Clinton-Gore, 6. This is a table created by a child for children. Where to start? First of all, in 1996, we didn't need any new tanks. The end of the Cold War had reduced the likelihood of an enormous tank battle across the plains of Central Europe to below zero. How many tanks do you think were requested in the first Bush-Cheney budget? Let's make a new chart, keeping Reagan, but also comparing the final Clinton-Gore defense budget with the first Bush-Cheney defense budget. Comparison of defense budgets. First item, new tanks requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 840. Clinton-Gore, zero. Bush-Cheney, zero. New tactical aircraft requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 399. Clinton-Gore, 52. Bush-Cheney, 58. New naval ships requested in president's budget. Reagan-Bush, 40. Clinton-Gore, 6. Bush-Cheney, 5. Got it, kids? The contrast could not be more stark. Bush-Cheney ordered 11% more tactical aircraft than Clinton-Gore, but Clinton-Gore ordered 20% more ships than Bush-Cheney. Did you know that in 1986 we were still fighting the Cold War? In current dollars, we spent $273 billion on defense in 1986 and $266 billion in 1996. Yes, that's 2% less, but then again, the Soviet Union no longer existed. The Clinton budget in 1996 was larger than the outgoing budget of the first Bush administration, a budget developed by then DOD Secretary Dick Cheney. During the 2000 campaign, it was the Republican ticket who ran against our military. It was, according to Bush and Cheney, hollowed out. Condoleezza Rice argued that Clinton had undercut our troops' ability to fight by sending them into what the Bush team called useless nation-building exercises. We were, George W. Bush said, at our lowest state of readiness since Pearl Harbor. I saw that movie, and let me tell you, our lack of preparedness caused some serious problems, not just for Ben Affleck, but for Josh Hartnett as well. 9 months after Bush took office, we went to war against the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. The Soviets couldn't conquer Afghanistan, neither could the British in 1919, but somehow we did it in a few weeks. With no new funding, the first Bush defense budget went into effect on October 1, 2002. Donald Rumsfeld had taken our gutted military and, with a little string and some baling wire, turned it into the greatest fighting force in the history of the planet. The man is a fucking genius. Or maybe Afghanistan and then Iraq was payoff for the revolution in military affairs in which Clinton invested so heavily. Take this scenario, described by Fred Kaplan of the Boston Globe. A U.S. Special Forces soldier sitting on horseback spots a Taliban target. He types out the information on his laptop computer and transmits the data to a Predator, a new unmanned drone flying 25,000 feet overhead. The Predator relays the data to commanders in Saudi Arabia, who direct the drone to the target for a closer look, and take a look themselves through its real-time video transmission. The commanders then send the target's coordinates to a U.S. bomber pilot in the area who punches the coordinates into the computer of a smart bomb. The bomb is fired and explodes within 3 feet of the target. "This sounds like science fiction, but it's really happening," said William M. Arkin, a defense consultant and adjunct professor at the U.S. Air Force School of Advanced Air Power Studies. More striking still, the whole process, from finding the target to dropping the bomb, takes 19 minutes. During the Gulf War, assigning a particular bomb to a particular target took 3 days. This is called network-centric warfare. Clinton's military brought it to fruition. It's about giving the on-scene commanders a much clearer picture of the battlefield. Let's take a look at how many tanks were involved. Zero. Ships. Zero. Yes, there was one tactical aircraft, but also a horse. Quickly, let's compare the military budgets of Lincoln and Reagan. Comparison of defense budgets. New horses requested in president's budget. Lincoln, 1864. 188,718. Reagan, 1984. 3. Why did Reagan gut our military? Was it because there was no evidence that the Soviet Union represented a threat to America and our friends and allies? No, it was because Ronald Reagan loathed our military. After all, he did dodge the draft during World War II. He served in the filmmaking department, starring in the 1942 comedy Juke Girl, alongside Ann Sheridan. Its tagline, "Sure, she's easy to meet, but try and forget her." In addition to falling down on the horse front, Reagan provided absolutely no funding for two of the other key elements of our war in Afghanistan. The Predator, a UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle, which went into production in 1997 and which was first used in Kosovo, and the JDAM, the Joint Direct Attack Munition. A word about JDAMs. During the first Gulf War, our smart bombs were laser-guided bombs that cost over $100,000 each. A JDAM, which costs about $20,000, is a recycled Cold War dumb bomb that has a global positioning system guidance unit strapped to it. I'm not certain about this, but I was told that Roger Clinton got the idea for the JDAM while installing a low jack on his 86 Camaro. Maybe that's apocryphal. In any case, JDAMs were funded and stockpiled during the Clinton administration. During the first Gulf War, less than 10% of the bombs and missiles dropped on Iraq were smart weapons. In our most recent war against Saddam, thanks to Clinton's JDAMs, that number jumped to over 70%. The result? Fewer civilian casualties and less damage to infrastructure that might be needed for the useless nation-building that our troops are now undertaking in Iraq. Captain Charles O'Brien, a company commander in Iraq, said the Kosovo experience has given his soldiers a foundation in stability support ops. That is, not getting killed by paramilitary forces, suicide bombers, etc. Turns out those peacekeeping operations in the Balkans that Sean Hannity went to war against are now saving American lives. Of course, there's a lot more to war than hardware and building on past experience. Every war brings with it a new set of tactical problems that have to be solved. Solving those problems speaks directly to the quality of our military leaders. As Don Rumsfeld noted, the credit for our battle plan in Iraq should go to General Tommy Franks. Franks was appointed to head the Central Command by the Clinton administration. And it wasn't just the battle plan. More important, as Lawrence J. Korb put it, was that the military forces that executed that plan so boldly and bravely were for the most part recruited, trained, and equipped by the Clinton administration. Who is Lawrence J. Korb? Well, he's currently Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He goes on to say of our swift victory in Iraq, "The fact of the matter is that most of the credit for the successful military operation should go to the Clinton administration." Oh, Korb was also Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Maybe he's the guy who screwed up on the horses. Let's review some quotes. Did Clinton gut the military because there was no evidence that countries like Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and an increasingly aggressive communist China would represent serious future threats to America and our friends and allies? No. Rather, it was because he loathed the military. Sean Hannity, Let Freedom Ring. If called on by the commander-in-chief today, two entire divisions of the Army would have to report, "Not ready for duty, sir." George W. Bush, August 3rd, 2000. Hi, Dr. Wolfowitz. Hey, the Clinton military did a great job in Iraq, didn't it? Al Franken. Fuck you, Paul Wolfowitz. A commander-in-chief leads the military built by those who came before him. There is little that he or his defense secretary can do to improve the force they have to deploy. It was all the work of previous administrations. Decisions made today shape the force of tomorrow. And when that war, the first Gulf War, ended, the first thing I did was to place a call to California and say thank you to President Ronald Reagan. Dick Cheney, the Southern Center for International Studies, August 2000. You suppose Clinton is waiting for Rumsfeld's call? Chapter 29. Fun with Racism. Strom Thurmond is dead. The news came in just this morning as I sat down to write a chapter on the Bush's family's close ties to the House of Saud, and through them to Osama bin Laden. Instead, to honor Thurmond's memory, I have decided to write on a topic close to his heart, racism. You'll remember the ruckus caused by Trent Lott's ill-considered remarks at Thurmond's wild 100th birthday party. Toasting the senator, Lott said, "When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him, we're proud of it, and if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years." The New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, and the rest of the liberal media were all there. But none found this bald nostalgia for segregation remarkable enough to report on. NPR's weekend edition preferred to run another of Lott's well-crafted tributes. "Somebody once said, and I'm not sure where I got this, but I heard it, and I loved it, and it applies to Strom Thurmond. Youth is a gift of nature. Age is a work of art. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a work of art." Sweet, don't you think? It's that old media bias for the awe moment. Unfortunately for Lott, C-SPAN cameras captured the event for everyone to enjoy. While the liberal media filed it as a heartwarming human interest story, some more discerning viewers were aghast at Lott's tribute to the Dixiecrats. Thanks to a few bloggers, the story took hold, and the controversy was up and running. In some ways, I thought the whole thing was a little unfair to Lott. The Dixiecrat platform wasn't just about segregation. It also included a pro-poll tax plank and a plank against anti-lynching laws. Plus, it called for stronger anti-miscegenation laws. Many people think of anti-miscegenation laws as being the same as segregation, but they're not. Miscegenation is about the mongrelization of the white race, which, to this day, is considered by some to be a crime against nature. One of the things that I was most puzzled about during the Lott controversy was that no one asked Thurmond what he thought about Lott's comments. He was not invited on any of the major network news shows. Some may say that this proves they have a liberal bias after all, but my friend Norm Ornstein has a more sinister theory. Ornstein, a senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, believes that Thurmond may have died as long as 3 years ago, and that the Republicans had been pursuing a weekend at Bernie's strategy because the governor of South Carolina is a Democrat and the GOP wanted to keep the seat. Once the controversy had gained momentum, almost no one was willing to defend Lott's remarks. Some conservative commentators couldn't resist using their de rigueur reprimands of Lott as a jumping-off point for malicious distortions of the history of U.S. racial politics. Sean Hannity was the poster boy for this conservative tick. Segregation is the legacy of the Democratic Party, Sean would say over and over again. He and his Klansmen, including Ann Coulter, base this on the true but fatuously disingenuous factoid that a higher percentage of Republican senators voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Act than Democrats. That's because racist Southern Democratic senators, like, say, Strom Thurmond, voted against the historic legislation. Southern Democrats. Dixiecrats. Get it? Sean knows very well that it was the liberal wing of the Democratic Party that ended segregation. He knows this because he lived in Newt Gingrich's ass from 1994 to 1998. So Sean had to have heard it when Newt declared it was the liberal wing of the Democratic Party that ended segregation. This was in Newt's historic speech to the House when he first took the gavel as Speaker. When President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, he is said to have turned to an aide and remarked, "We have just lost the South for a generation." The Republican Party became the home to Southern bigots and still is today. While the Democratic Party lost the South that year, they did gain my dad. A lifelong Republican who voted for Herbert Hoover and every GOP presidential candidate through Nixon in 1960, Dad switched parties in 1964 because the Republican nominee, Barry Goldwater, had voted against the Civil Rights Act. Dad, a card-carrying member of the NAACP, always told us that Jews couldn't be against civil rights. He never voted Republican again. 5 weeks before Thurmond's birthday party, Georgia's Democratic governor, Roy Barnes, lost his race for re-election. As governor, Barnes had reduced the size of the Confederate emblem on the state flag, and his opponent, Sonny Perdue, seized on it as an issue. 180,000 more rural white voters turned out in 2002 than had in 1998. I spoke with Max Cleland, who, in addition to being pictured with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, was buried by the racist avalanche in Georgia and lost his Senate re-election bid. Here's how Cleland described it.
Basically, when Roy Barnes changed the flag, you know, that was it. That was a straw that broke the camel's back. A lot of people were angry at Roy and arrogance and all that kind of stuff. But that was a straw that broke the camel's back. And what happened was Ralph Reed then took the hatchet and buried us. He took the hatchet that Roy Barnes gave him by push-polling in the Republican suburbs and in South Georgia. This question, the Democrats are trying to take away Georgia's culture. Mm-hmm. See, and that was a push poll, and it came off the charts, especially with white males. Mm-hmm. He turned, like he did abortion, like he did everything else, prayer and everything. He turned the flag into a cultural issue, and white males respond to those cultural issues. And, you know, like, they're for the blacks. So it became quickly a racial issue. In the South, if all politics are local, all politics are racial mm-hmm. in the South.
In January, I gave one of my enormously popular corporate speeches to the South Carolina Bar Association in Charleston, where I learned that the Confederate flag is still a huge issue in the Palmetto State. That same day, I heard someone on Fox News call John Walker Lind a traitor, which he was. He was a traitor because he fought against soldiers wearing the uniform of the United States of America. Terrible traitor. You know who were the worst traitors in the history of our country? The Confederates. They took up arms against soldiers wearing the uniform of the United States of America, but they were much, much worse than John Walker Lind because they killed hundreds of thousands of American troops. And for what cause? So they could whip and torture black people. Why would anyone want to put up a flag honoring that? To give you some idea of just how evil and anti-American the Confederates were, here's a rough comparison between the American deaths caused by the Confederates and those caused by the most evil of our enemies today. Osama bin Laden, 3,000. Saddam Hussein, 512. Jefferson Davis, 360,000. How could you possibly claim to be against traitors like John Walker Lind, yet want to publicly display the battle flag of the most murderous, anti-American betrayers in history? No offense to my Southern readers and fans, but I don't get it. I was talking to a Southerner about this the other day, and he said, well, you know, the Nazis were bad, but we drive around in Volkswagens. I said, yeah, but we don't put a Volkswagen on top of the state capitol. Now, don't get me wrong. Republicans aren't just racist in the South. Take California, where earlier this year, the highest-ranking African-American in the state GOP sent an angry email to party leaders. Black Republicans are expected to provide window dressing and cover to prove that this is not a racist party, yet our own leadership continues to act otherwise, Party Secretary Shannon Reeves wrote to his fellow party board members. Reeves wrote his comments because State Republican Vice Chairman Bill Back had sent out an email containing an article by someone else suggesting that the nation would have been better off if the South had won the Civil War. Reeves went on to describe some of his experiences as a black Republican. As a Bush delegate at the 2000 convention in Philadelphia, I proudly wore my delegate's badge and Republican National Committee lapel pin as I worked the convention. Regardless of the fact that I was obviously a delegate prominently displaying my credentials, no less than 6 times did white delegates dismissively tell me to fetch them a taxi or carry their luggage. It's no wonder that Republicans have a hard time attracting blacks to the party. Being black and Republican can have its rewards, however. At the 2000 convention in Philadelphia, every Republican African-American elected official in the country got to speak from the podium. City councilmen, county executives, state legislators, they all got to speak. Except one guy, Morris Temple, the county coroner from London, Ohio. And he was pissed. I was covering the convention for ABC Radio and interviewed him. Yeah, I'm angry. I'm damn angry. Every other black elected official in the whole damn country got to speak from that podium except me. Oh, the Bush people told me that there was another guy, some motor vehicle commissioner from Maryland. Turns out the guy was Filipino. Okay, I made up the whole Morris Temple story, but everything else here is true. In the 2000 presidential election, George W. Bush got 8% of the black vote. The African-American office holders that were paraded on the podium in Philadelphia were not intended to attract black votes. They were presented for the consumption of suburban whites who don't want to vote for an overtly racist party, the kind of party that would deliberately purge the voting rolls in Florida of tens of thousands of blacks who should never have been purged. White suburban voters don't want to vote for a party that would try to suppress black turnout in 2002 by putting out flyers in black neighborhoods saying, "Urgent notice. Come out to vote November 6th. Before you come out to vote, pay your parking tickets, motor vehicle tickets, your rent, and most importantly, any warrants." The election, of course, was November 5th. So it's a balancing act. Pursue Nixon's Southern strategy, flog the flag in Georgia and South Carolina, suppress votes in black neighborhoods, but feature the black Republican school board treasurer from Monroe, Louisiana, at your national convention. And by all means, anytime you can, flaunt Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. In January, when President Bush announced that his administration would file a pair of legal briefs against the University of Michigan's undergraduate and law school admissions programs, the White House told the Washington Post that Ms. Rice had been one of the prime movers behind the president's decision, and that after a series of lengthy one-on-one meetings with Bush, she drew on her experience as provost at Stanford University to help convince him that favoring minorities was not an effective way of improving diversity on college campuses. The next day, the New York Times reported that a dismayed Rice was, quote, so troubled by the article in the Washington Post that she announced that she believed universities should be able to use race as a factor in admissions policies, a view that may put her at odds with Mr. Bush. In other words, the White House had been lying to the Post. And while Bill Bennett and Sean Hannity told Fox audiences that any use of race as a factor in admissions was abhorrent, the only two blacks the Republicans ever point to, Rice and Powell, think it's an appropriate tool. Perhaps Rice and Powell knew something about the world that the rest of the Bush administration doesn't know. When I give my corporate speeches, almost invariably I open up with this line. Looking out at your faces today, I can see that this group hasn't caved into that whole affirmative action nonsense. Sometimes the audience of mid to top level executives will look around, see all the white faces, and laugh. Most of the time, they just burst out laughing right away. I had a baseball coach pose this question to me. You have two guys run down to first. They have equal times, but one has much better form. Which one do you choose? You choose the one with the bad form. You can coach him to use good form, and he'll beat the other guy. In the same way, blind adherence to SAT scores and GPAs is ridiculous. Take two kids, one white and one black. The white kid's in private school, has educated parents, opportunities to travel, intensive SAT tutoring. He takes the SATs three times and submits his highest score, 1280. The black kid is brought up by a single mom who didn't graduate from high school. No books in the house, works after school, shares a room with two brothers. No SAT tutoring, takes it once, gets an 1120. You'd take the black kid, right? Except I forgot, the white kid's dad was your roommate in college. You spray-painted the dean's car together sophomore year. That was fun. Remember the look on Dean Whitehead's face? Oh, and your brother does a lot of business with the family. Hard not to take the white kid. Of course, most white kids don't have these advantages, but almost no black kids do. We don't live in a race-blind society. Two professors, one from MIT, the other from the University of Chicago, proved it with an elegant experiment. The professors selected 1,250 job advertisements in Boston and Chicago. To each employer, they submitted two pairs of made-up resumes, one pair of highly qualified candidates, and one pair of average candidates. In each pair, one had a black name like Tamika or Tyrone, and one had a white name like Amy or Brad. The professors found that the white names were 50% more likely to be called for an interview than the black names. George W. Bush was the beneficiary of affirmative action in more ways than we'll probably ever know. He got into Yale after a lackluster career at Andover. What people don't realize is that, like the University of Michigan, Yale had a point system when Bush applied in 1964. George W. received 5 points for being the son of a Yale graduate, 20 points for being the grandson of an extremely important Yale graduate who was a U.S. senator and a Yale trustee, and a point for being a cheerleader at Andover. He almost didn't make it, though, because he lost 10 points for showing up drunk to the interview. Fortunately, he got 30 points for being a Bush with over a 920 on his SATs, and he slipped through. I'm not saying that all Republicans are racist or that all racists are Republican. That would be a reprehensible overstatement akin to something Ann Coulter might say. But if Ann Coulter were a Democrat, she would point out that after years of declining during Clinton, black poverty is now on the increase. And she would make great use of the fact that youth poverty among blacks is now at its highest level in the 23 years they've been keeping the statistic. And she'd blame it all on Bush. She'd claim it was because of overt, deliberate racism rather than his more general bias toward the already privileged. She might even say that his tax cuts are inherently racist because not only are blacks disproportionately likely to be at the bottom of the economic ladder, but they're disproportionately unlikely to be at the top. But that's Ann. I personally would never accuse Bush's tax cuts of being racially motivated. I just think that very generally speaking, they happen to hurt black people and help rich people who tend, again, generally, to be white. That's all I'm saying. During the whole Trent Lott mess, Gene Weingarten, a writer for the Washington Post, found a great website run by an obscure group called the African American Republican Leadership Council. The site, www.aarlc.org, seeks to dispel the myth that the Republican Party has lost touch with blacks and is determined to break the, quote, liberal Democrat stranglehold over black America. At the time, the group's official 15-person advisory panel included Sean Hannity, Grover Norquist, Gary Bauer, and Paul Weyrich. All but two of the 15 members of the advisory panel of the African American Republican Leadership Council were white. The site did list former Massachusetts Senator Edward W. Brooke III, a genuine African American, as the panel's honorary chairman. So Weingarten called Brooke, who told the reporter they had never heard of the group and had no idea why his name was on the site. Weingarten called the man identified as the group's political spokesman and asked him why there weren't more African Americans associated with the African American Advisory Panel. The spokesman, Kevin L. Martin, said, "I'd like there to be more, but let's be honest. Right now, the Republican Party and African Americans have a large rift." I don't know about you, but I think it's a little sad that since J.C. Watts left the House, the number one black leader in the Republican Party is Sean Hannity. Chapter 30. I'm a bad liar. I never lie. That is, unless it's absolutely necessary. So, the story I'm about to tell you is a little embarrassing. It starts 2.5 years ago. My son Joe, a junior in a very high-powered, expensive New York City private high school, was beginning his college search. We started to put together a list of schools to visit during spring break. The boy wants to be an engineer, so MIT, Michigan, Washington University, and Princeton were early contenders. My wife, who I have to tell you is not usually funny, had a hilarious idea. Why don't I take Joe down to Bob Jones University as a prospective student, which technically he was, and have fun at their expense? Great idea, honey. Hilarious. We could ask them all kinds of snarky questions in the information session, like about their interracial dating policy. Because of bad publicity, Bob Jones had changed the policy since Bush's visit. Now, according to news reports, they were allowing kids to date interracially with their parents' permission. I understand the students need their parents' permission to date other races. I was wondering, my wife is fine with Joe dating a black girl, but I'm against it. How would that work out? Or, on your interracial dating policy, I have a theoretical question. Tiger Woods, could he date anyone or no one? Could he even go out by himself? Oddly enough, the answer to that last question I would learn was no, unless Tiger was leaving campus either to go home or on a mission. Excited about all the comic possibilities, I immediately asked my assistant Liz to call BJU, which is what they call themselves. Find out when they have information sessions and tours. Liz called and found the people in the BJU admissions office to be incredibly friendly. I mention this because it will become a leitmotif for the rest of this chapter. Of course, there were plenty of information sessions and tours. Come on down anytime. We'd love to get to know Joe. What's he interested in? Liz did her best. The boy's into history. Great. That afternoon, when Joe got back from his fancy two-thirds Jewish high school, I told him the good news. We're going to go on a little comedy adventure. Joe, and in retrospect, this is to the boy's credit, was absolutely appalled. No! What? I said incredulously. This was my son who grew up in a comedy household. Didn't he recognize a great idea? Leave these people alone, he said angrily. What did they do to you? Well, they're racist and nuts and dad. They just have a different belief system. Leave them alone. And that, I thought, was that. What I didn't understand was that when you contact an evangelical organization, they will not stop mailing you shit. Did you know that BJU has quite a history department? Did you know that BJU cheerleaders wear skirts down to their ankles? It's in their brochure. And then there were the calls. Hi, is Joe there? Who may I say is calling? Josie Martin from Bob Jones University? Joe's not here now. When will he be back? I don't know. This happened a lot. And because I'm a busy man and my wife wasn't vigilant enough, Joe actually answered a few times, getting angrier and angrier at me because he was now being forced to lie, something we Frankens don't do unless it's absolutely necessary. The last straw was the call from a junior at BJU who was from Manhattan. Where, he asked Joe, do you go to church? I don't go to church, Joe answered reflexively. On the other end of the phone, he heard a shocked gasp. In Manhattan, Joe quickly recovered. I go to church on Long Island. Oh, said the very nice young man who my son was lying to. Joe charged out of his room and confronted me. This has got to stop. I don't like lying to people. He told me to call Bob Jones and tell them he had decided to go to a secular college, which was, of course, entirely true. So the next day, I had Liz call and tell BJU the bad news. They were disappointed but understood and were extremely nice about it. Cut to Team Franken, present day. A good idea never dies. I needed a kid without Joe's integrity. Fortunately, I was at Harvard. Among the 14 members of Team Franken, I had 14 volunteers, including Owen Kane, a 38-year-old mid-career Kennedy School grad student. But to maximize the chances of our little scheme working, it was important that my son or daughter be able to pass for a high school junior. Owen was out. Andrew Barr was in. A sophomore at the college, Andrew was perfect. Fresh-faced, eager, he could easily pass for 17. Valedictorian at Boston Latin, the top public school in Boston, Andrew was razor-sharp and quick on his feet. Only one problem, the Jewish thing. Neither Andrew nor I knew jack about Christianity, particularly the weird, freakish kind practiced by these incredibly nice people at Bob Jones University. We decided to do our homework. Learning about Christianity would be too difficult and time-consuming. Also boring. Instead, we checked out BJU's website, hoping not just to learn enough to pull off our scam, but also to find stuff to make fun of. Unfortunately, we discovered that the interracial dating policy had been discarded altogether. Shit. There went the Tiger Woods joke. But not to worry, there was plenty of other fodder. First of all, the university is not accredited. That's right. They have the same degree-granting power as Schlotsky's Deli. They claim it's because they don't want to be accredited. We think it's because they don't believe in science. You see, they stand without apology for the absolute authority of the Bible. God created the earth in 6 days, and he didn't put gays in it either. Then there's the BJU policy on student use of the internet, which is, quote, a source of much content antagonistic to godliness. No argument there. Chat rooms, instant messaging, and web-based email accounts are banned. Students are not allowed to access websites with, quote, biblically offensive material. In addition to the usual pornography and violence, this includes, quote, crude vulgar language or gestures, tasteless humor, excretory functions, etc., and graphic medical photos. Fortunately, BJU has an automatic filter updated daily to block these websites. And, since nobody's perfect, i.e., we're all sinners, if the filter picks up a student attempting to access one of these websites, the incident is logged for an internet administrator. In fact, all internet use is constantly monitored by the university, giving parents real peace of mind. Like the incredible friendliness, constant monitoring would also become a theme of life at BJU. And speaking of parents, Andrew and I found the linchpin for what would become our elaborate ruse. On the BJU website is a letter telling parents that it is their God-given responsibility not to allow their children to choose their own college. The consequences of that are made clear in the vivid and terrifying stories of the three college shipwrecks, written by Bob Jones Sr., the founder of the university. The first two shipwrecks, known as His Only Daughter and The Pride of His Mother, come to alarmingly similar ends. In each, a promising, God-fearing student is allowed to go off to a secular university. After returning from their freshman years, both have lost their way, their faith shattered. The only daughter rushed upstairs, stood in front of a mirror, took a gun, and blew out her brains. Whereas the pride of his mother, having contracted an unspeakable disease, announces his intention to buy a gun and blow out my brains. The third shipwreck, the son of an aged minister, is less violent, though certainly just as tragic. He had been a great boy, bright, clean, obedient Christian. Unfortunately, although the boy makes the life-saving decision to attend a Christian school, it isn't BJU. Quote, a skeptic had got into the science department of the less Christian Christian school, and when the boy returns home, he has lost his faith and becomes a drunken, atheistic bum. So, parents could save their kids from suicide, alcoholism, and the clap by forcing them to go to BJU. Excellent. This was our key. Since neither Andrew nor I could pull off being devout evangelical Christians, it would be Andrew's mother who desperately wanted him to go to Bob Jones University. Instead of being Andrew's father, I would be a friend of the family. In fact, the best friend of Andrew's father, who had died tragically of brain cancer. No, wait, boating accident, 3 years ago. Andrew's mom had sunk into a deep depression, then miraculously found Christ. It was perfect. Neither Andrew nor I would have to know anything. But why wasn't Mom there? Sick? No. Threw out her back carrying boxes of blood at a blood drive at church. As you can see, we started putting way too much thought into the backstory and way too little into the fact that I've been on television for nearly 30 years. But seeing as how we did spend the time on the backstory, you really should hear it, because it's pretty good. Andrew's father, Hank, my college roommate and financial advisor, ran an incredibly successful hedge fund. Andrew's mother, Ellen, therefore, was not just a stunningly beautiful widow, she looks like Naomi Judd, but also fabulously wealthy. Now for the delicious spin. I was more than just a family friend. I had my eye on the widow Barr, and seeing to it that young Andrew would agree to attend Bob Jones would be a feather in my cap. Andrew's part was equally delicious. Eager to please his mother, he had happily agreed to visit what he thought was just a typical fun-in-the-sun Christian school. Our plan, as you can clearly see, was brilliant. Neither of us would have to know anything about either Christianity or Bob Jones University. We had thought of everything. And yes, I considered the possibility that I would be recognized. A disguise? Nah. I just cut my hair extra short. Yeah, that would do it.
Hi, Mr. Franken. Big fan. Good to see you, Mr. Franken. Loved you on SNL.
These were the security guards at LaGuardia. Nothing to worry about. We were still in New York. Didn't mean the haircut wasn't working. We arrived in Greenville. The Hertz rent-a-car gal, also a big fan. That's good, I explained to Andrew. It's good to have a fan base. But this Hertz woman, she wasn't a nutcase evangelical. She watched secular TV. Don't worry. So we got to Bob Jones around 11 a.m., drove through the gate, didn't set off the Jew alarm. We're in. Take a look around. Not an unattractive campus. Buildings, grass, nice day. But the place was eerily devoid of human activity. We'd soon learn that everyone was at chapel, this being a weekday. Out of the car and into the administration building. At the desk, an extremely friendly, well-scrubbed, wide-eyed young man greeted us and sent us along into the admissions office, where we were met by an extremely friendly, well-scrubbed, wide-eyed female staffer. Like every woman at BJU, she wore a skirt that covered not just her upper thigh, but her lower thigh, and her knee, and her calf, and her well-turned or not well-turned ankle. No real way of knowing. But she was really nice and showed us the official admissions video, which featured two miniature pirates who introduced themselves as your guardians. At BJU, they told us, you're never alone. Remember I said constant monitoring would be a theme? The creepy mini pirates weren't kidding. We scheduled a 1 p.m. interview with Gerald. All names have been changed to protect me, and decided to grab some lunch, joining the mass of students pouring out of chapel and into the dining commons. There were thousands of them, young men in shirts and ties and khakis, young women in their ankle-length skirts.